David, thank you for your remarks. I want to open with a quick story. I went to Israel on vacation, and we signed up for an IDF anti-terrorism training session. We were put together in a team of four people, and the young Israeli female soldier asked our group of four to choose our leader. And I said, the question answers itself. It's Debbie August. She's amazing. She's a total take-charge person, and she can lead us anywhere. Her husband, Glenn, readily agreed. How did your experience in the Israeli army help you distinguish between leadership and management?
That's a very, very good question. There is a significant difference between a military leader versus a business leader. In the military, in 99% of the cases, you only lead. You are told what to do by higher-ups, and you just need to execute well. That is completely the opposite in business. In business, you are rarely told what to do. You are expected to evaluate the situation yourself, dissect it, make all the observations, arrive at conclusions, make recommendations, and execute. You may need to get approval of higher-ups, but the role is completely different. In a military, a great leader is the one who can do the leadership role. In a business side, is the one who first comes up with the right solutions, and the leading itself becomes secondary.
In the book, The Desert Fox, the biography of German General Rommel, the author describes Rommel's battle management philosophy. Rommel would tell his lieutenants to take that hill, and he would also explain the battlefield objective, like not losing the river was critical, and the hill was a secondary item. In the fog of war, Rommel wanted to give his lieutenants agency to achieve the overall objective. The best managers give agency to their people, even in the military.
The objective is to have a successful outcome. How do I accomplish that outcome? You need to have multiple people perform different tasks to be well coordinated. But more importantly, they need to understand exactly what the tasks are. And since there are always surprises, nothing goes according to plan, they need to be able to improvise on the spot how to react to changing environment, changing conditions. It is extremely important to make sure that everybody on the team from top to bottom understands precisely what the outcome that is expected, where is some leeway to make changes, what is a do or die or what is not. It's the compromises day to day in the field that will yield the outcome you want.
When you evaluate a venture capital investment in tech, do you pay more attention to the technology or the quality of the management team? Business plans and technology change all the time. Does that mean we should focus more on the quality of management and their ability to adapt?
I want to make sure that the technology in principle is of real value. I'm willing to accept the observation that you made that it is likely to change. A change in technology depends on how the architecture of that technology was built. If the technology was built to be flexible and accommodate specific changes over time, then you'll be able to make the changes with good management. But if the technology was not built with an architecture that has flexibility for changes, then no good managers will be able to succeed.
I want to talk about new product development. We had Michael Hiltzik and John Gertner on this program speak about Bell Labs and Xerox PARC. These industrial labs had great technology, great scientists, and brilliant ideas like the mouse. But it went nowhere. There was this concept that if we put great engineers across disciplines together and give them sufficient funding, that they would change the world. And then these labs were closed. Why do these famous industrial labs fail in new product innovation while entrepreneurial startups succeeded?
Most of the technological breakthroughs that really change things don't happen by design. It is a creative ingenuity by a single individual who changes the paradigm. Successful technologies do not come from predetermined plans on how to build it, but rather an innovation that occurred by an individual that saw a tremendous breakthrough. The innovation comes first, only then the questions of how we build a product that is commercially successful becomes important. The reason that industrial parks don't work all that well is because they lack real innovation. Real innovations are less predictable, do not necessarily depend on money or the number of people involved. A corporate environment, as a result, is not very conducive to innovation because an inventor can be unproductive for 5 years, and then suddenly in the sixth year, it happens. In a corporate environment, they won't allow you to be unproductive for an extended period of time. The large corporation is good at many things, but not necessarily inventing new technologies. So if I were to manage a large corporation, my strategy would be not to invent anything, but rather I would look to buy small companies that invented something and then put my corporate resources where my strengths are, which is to make commercial product and support it.
Let's change topics to the rule of 80-20. It has such applicability in life in every dimension. Please explain the rule of 80-20 and how it applies.
Yeah, that's fascinating. It's a little counterintuitive. The 80-20 rule says the following. 20% of any group is responsible for 80% of the output of that group. 20% are very productive, the other 80% are not. And it's true in everything about life. If you look at any work environment, 20% would be good, while 80% would be pedestrian, kind of towing the line, but not impressive, relative to the 20%. That's the key. The same holds true for expert advice you may get about how to become successful in business. 80% of that advice is likely to be pedestrian, but 20% is going to be insightful. Just because one has a great resume, it does not necessarily mean that they are also one of the top 20 percentiles. There is very little correlation between past track record of success and being one of the 20 percentiles. So whenever you listen to anybody, no matter what their resume looks like, you have to ask yourself, do I believe that that person is one of the 20 percenters or one of the 80 percenters?
If you have a group of 100, 20 will produce 80% of the product. And then what I find even more amazing is that when you remove the 80 and you have the remaining select group of 20, the rule of 80-20 applies even to that highly select pool. In that group of 20, the top four produce 80% of the value of the product as well. So from the original group of 100, an incredible 64% of all the output comes from the four most productive people.
That is correct. I will tell you a funny story here. My benefactor, mentor, and a key investor when I raised my own fund is a guy by the name of Charles Wong. And Charles Wong was the founder, CEO, and chairman of a company, Computer Associates. Charles pointed me to the significance of the 80-20 rule. He says, you know what? When I started Computer Associate, we were three people that designed, programmed, and sold it to the market. We grew to become hundreds of millions in sales. It's still the same product, but I have now 200 people trying to change and maintain it. He says, why does it take 200 people to change and maintain something that it took three people to build? And he gave me the conclusion and he said, here is what happens. When a development team comes to me and it comes and tells me we are late, we're not going to be able to deliver the deadline. We need more people. He says, I have a different way. I ask him to identify the 20 bottom and I tell him lose them. I don't add, I subtract people. Those bottom 20 are actually a drag because they have to be supervised. So if you just get him out of the equation, the remaining 80 will be able to be much more productive.
When COVID started, I called a buddy of mine who is an entrepreneur who had about 100 employees. And I asked him, what you doing? And he said, well, I can only have 20 essential employees at work. And I said, how productive are they? Oh, they're very productive. They probably produce 80% of the value out of the company. And I said, well, by that logic, why don't you just discard the other 80 employees? And he said, well, it's easy for you to say that, but the reality is, God forbid one of those 20 leaves, I'm toast. At least I got the other guys in reserve. And there's all these little projects, little things that need to be done. You're right, they're not that productive. How do you think about that as a problem? It's slightly different from getting rid of your least productive 20 employees. It's that we still need the other 80 guys, even if they're not particularly productive.
First, your logic is consistent with what I described, and it's proven by what it told you. But although it made a wise observation, it would be and feel counterintuitive to everybody else. The second observation is you couldn't possibly have in the world all businesses made up of 20 percentiles, because 80% would be unemployed. 80% of them are not as productive, but their performance is perfectly acceptable. The way that management works with the 20% is not by firing everybody else, but rather by compensating the 20% and giving them better promotions. They don't go the step farther that says, I could do only with the 20%, why don't I get rid of the 80 and make more money? The second observation, 80% becomes the norm. There are companies that only can be satisfied with the top 20. Consulting firms that do strategy work, investment bankers that do very complicated transactions, the top law firms, they get rid of the bottom 20% every year. They literally will ask people to leave if they are ranked at the bottom. This way, they always refresh, and they will end up with a group that would be 20% everywhere else, but within their organization, even though they're all 20 percentiles relative to the rest of the world, there'll still be the 20-80 rule. Only one will be a genius minus, the other one will be a genius plus. That's how they separate at that point. Because those firms view their job as providing what I call insight. If they provided common sense kind of observations, there would be no need and role for them. So they're being called upon because the corporation perceives their problem to be something that they have tried to tackle and were unsuccessful and needed help in finding solutions. The missing element is what I call astuteness, insightfulness, that brain power. So when the consulting firms are being called upon, they have to be more insightful. They have to be smarter than the client on the average, or else they'll be unsuccessful in finding a solution. Because remember, very smart people in the firm that have already been working there in the industry for years have been unable to tackle and solve it.
I want to discuss failure. Leo Melamed spoke on What Happens Next, and he said what distinguishes the American capitalist system from the Chinese communist system is that there is a greater tolerance for failure. You may have done the right thing, it just didn't work. How do you think about tolerance of failure and management's willingness to accept it and lever it for the next project?
I rarely look at failure as a reason to exclude anybody. However, I want to see some success. If I can be convinced that he had success, then failures become an advantage because it tells me that they have learned and they can be more careful and wiser in my project than a person that had never experienced failure.
30 years ago, Salomon Brothers hired the Nobel Prize winner, Myron Schulz. And I walked into his office and I said to Myron, hi, I'm Larry Bernstein. I'd like to work on a project with you. And he said, okay, what are your passions in business? And I said, tax policy and derivatives. And he said, this is going to work out just great. And it took chutzpah. And in your book, you showed chutzpah. You tell the story of when you were denied access to the school of your choice. So you snuck into the office of the head of Israel's Ministry of Education. I think you were 13 years old, and you walked in without an appointment, and the minister looked at you strangely and said, "Who are you? What are you doing here, young man?" And then you made your case as to why he had the power to change your life. And he said, "All right, I'll make this happen." And you got into the school of your choice. How important is chutzpah?
Chutzpah is great. I define chutzpah to be gumption, that you are not bashful and portray confidence that you can do it. However, chutzpah by the world is defined in two dimensions. The other part of it is behaviorally doing something that the other person may not like. That's why it's called chutzpah. So the best answer is have the chutzpah, but don't deliver it in a chutzpah way. Deliver it in a way that is much more conducive. You don't want to come across as being a one big pain in the butt. Without that chutzpah, getting into the best school would not have happened for me. The Israeli minister probably appreciated that a 13-year-old kid had that kind of a chutzpah to go to the Minister of Education, sneak into his office, and make demands. But if I were not a kid, I'm not sure that I would have gotten a very sympathetic response. That again brings up, you need the chutzpah, but you need to be very cognizant in the delivery of that chutzpah, because without that delivery, you run a risk that you're not going to get your way.
One of the great things about America is that you don't have to succeed in every moment. You can make mistakes. You can fall off track. You can graduate college in 6 years and not four, or not graduate at all. You can educate yourself. You didn't go to Harvard, David. You worked your way up from a lower middle class community in Israel and end up in the top echelon of American business.
So, tongue in cheek first, you better have some chutzpah. I was never short on chutzpah by virtue of growing up in a country where it's pretty common. However, over time, I learned how to be more effective in communicating that you are capable and will be able to perform and just give me a chance without being offensive. You need to be able to compete with the rest of the world, because really advancement in America and in a capitalistic system is being better than other people. You want to place yourself in the 20 percentiles. It's the ability to be more insightful than the average person that gets you there. I started always looking for the insights of things, noticing nuances that are not so obvious to other people, noticing exceptions that are not so obvious to other people, taking common wisdom statements that other people take for granted and showing, you know, yeah, you're right, but there is a twist to that. That really is what propelled me to the top.
One of the case studies in your book relates to a junior high video that your daughter produced about a colorful singing toll booth operator named Jack. And in the video, your daughter used the song "Hit the Road, Jack," and she won the video contest to place the video on CNN. But the network said they needed copyright permission to use the song. And your daughter was informed by the personal assistant to the copyright holder that the owner had never given permission to use the song. What you told your daughter is that you need to get into the shoes of the copyright holder and understand his worldview and try to appreciate why he got to the answer no. And if you can figure out the worldview of your negotiating partner, then maybe you'll have a chance to come up with a creative solution to the problem. How do you put yourself in the shoes of your negotiating counterpart?
That's a superb observation, and that's insightful advice that you just gave, which most people rarely follow. There is a significant difference in the way most people think when they solve problems. So instead of looking at what makes sense to you, try to project yourself into what makes sense from the other perspective. Start paying attention to the what, why, how, and everything else. Don't just be happy with, oh, they decided to agree. And you're happy, okay, I made a proposal, they agreed, what do I need to know? I spent my early life asking, what were the arguments? Who said yes, who said no? What were the arguments for yes? What were the arguments for no? What at the end affected the scale? What at the end were people able to convince with? And you get a whole different perspective from the other side. from what it took for the other people to make a decision.
What advice do you have for negotiating a deal?
If you want to be a good negotiator, you need to be able to negotiate both sides of the argument at the same time. Train your mind to start thinking in advance about the quality of your position. It's the difference between thinking about it from your perspective only and putting yourself in the other person's shoes. So to me, a good negotiator is somebody who is able to think in advance what the counter arguments might be, what the weaknesses of your own arguments are. It's not to be quick on your feet. Making up answers on the spot is basically a loser's game.
David, you work hard. You dig. You try to find data. You ask lots of questions. You like to investigate things that have been overlooked by other people. How important is effort in terms of your success?
I've been a very hardworking person, and I spend the time and effort and the energy physically. But that's not what contributed to my success. The determinative criteria are not to be physically lazy, but rather not to be intellectually lazy. Working hard is not critical. What is most important is to think hard. So I outperform other people by not being intellectually lazy and outthinking other people, which in the book I call insightfulness. And I think that is really the secret. Always try to stay away from buying into the common wisdom, buying into the obvious. More importantly, one doesn't need to have a very high IQ to do it well. Pay attention to non-obvious things. That's where most people are lazy. They pay attention to the obvious thing, draw conclusions, and they think they have a solution. I will always focus on whether there are exceptions, whether there are nuances, and then suggest a different path.
I had a book club years ago with Stuart Diamond, who is a professor who specializes in negotiation at the Wharton School. He's written a book entitled Getting More. Stuart Diamond suggested meeting your counterpart to try to figure out his perspective and all elements about his decision-making process. His advice, just keep asking more questions. And then you can use all that information you gathered to come up with a solution that fits both of your criteria.
You gave your listeners the solution. I recognized earlier on that I needed to change my interpersonal skills. I needed to change my chutzpah. I hate to change my self-orientation where I was at the center and try to appreciate what people who are responsible for the outcome will think or do. I started asking questions, that's the answer. Because when you ask the what, why, and how, you will get a treasure trove of knowledge that you will be able to use to predict exactly what he will do and what the outcome is likely to be.
David, I end each session on a note of optimism. What are you optimistic about?
We have a very divisive society here in America. And everybody is arguing a single point of view and having to win and damn the other side of the argument. It's not a very healthy trend. I'm optimistic that it will most likely change because the business world is exactly opposite in thinking. You will never succeed in business not listening to other people, not understanding how other people think. And you will fail if you start only with the proposition that what you want is important, what other people want is not important. So over time, those people who are in politics or the younger people who tend to fall more prey to that, as they transition into business, they will realize that behavior is a recipe for failure in business. They will not want to fail, and they will start opening their minds, just like I did when I was younger. So business is the counterforce to the politics the younger generations are taught by academicians who I believe have the wrong perspective.
Henry Ford said you can have any color car you want as long as it was black. In contrast, we had the Burger King philosophy, which was have a burger your way. Just tell us what you want, we'll make it. And I think it's that latter philosophy that is superior. And I think Ford learned his lesson when he refused to make a car other than black when competitors showed up with colored vehicles and took market share.
That's exactly right. That's exactly right. You cannot be closed-minded and be successful in business. You cannot not listening to experts and other arguments and be successful in business. And that is the missing ingredient in where we are headed right now in the political and media arena. But financial motivations are very strong, and that's the only chance we have to reverse the trend. If we change from a capitalistic system to a different system, a government force system that says it's my way or the highway. So by losing the capitalistic system, the economic engine that drives us, we will absolutely aggravate this downhill spiral trend towards being a very autocratic, very authoritarian society.
Ari Cement and David Cromfeld, thank you so much for joining us today. That ends today's session. But let me make a plug for next week's show. I expect next week's program to be the most popular one of the year because it's on Bitcoin. Our speaker is Chris Giancarlo, and he is known in the Twitter universe as Crypto Dad. Chris is the former chairman of the Commodities Futures Trading Commission, or the CFTC, and he was responsible for approving Bitcoin futures, which are now traded on the Cboe and CME. Chris is incredibly bullish on the future of cryptocurrencies, and he thinks that blockchain will disrupt the ways we do financial transactions and payments. Chris thinks we're on the cusp of a revolution that will change finance. And our younger generation has already embraced a lot of these ideas embedded in the crypto world, and the old guard needs to embrace change and fully engage. I recommend that you ask your kids to listen to the show and that everyone read Chris's new book, Crypto Dad, this holiday season. If you're interested in listening to a replay of today's What Happens Next program or any of our previous episodes, or if you wish to read a transcript, you can find them at our website, whathappensnextin6minutes.com. Replays are also available on Apple Podcasts, Podbean, and Spotify. I would like to thank our listeners for their time and for engaging with these complex issues. Goodbye.